This week's guest specializes in helping people of color take care of their mental health, especially in New Hampshire, where their experiences with racism are often dismissed, while working to support other therapists of color break into the profession. I'm Matt Maury, co-publisher and executive editor of Business NH Magazine and Granite Media Group.
And I'm Christine Kerrigan, co-publisher of Business NH Magazine and chief creative officer for Granite Media Group. And welcome to BizCast NH.
So, Christine, I think, you know, with today's guest, it's a perfect time to obviously talk about something that people don't talk about enough, which is the state of their own mental health.
Yes.
Because we get nervous, like, I'm the only one that thinks this way, or I'm the only one that's struggling this way.
Yeah.
And I think in recent years, we've seen stigma lifting around that. And I think it almost needed to after the pandemic, because I know I'm an introvert, so I thought, like, I am built for this. I'm ready. Like, I don't have to see people. I don't have to come up with excuses not to go out to things.
I'm right there with you, Matt.
But, you know, it was such a hard time on top of just the stress of the unknown at that time. And then my kids were home and my wife was home. And so all of a sudden we're living together 24/7, which I love them all. But especially at that time, we were in a two-bedroom, one-bathroom ranch house.
Right.
And that was a lot of togetherness, especially the boys shared a room. And there just wasn't a way to really – I mean, we tried to have outings and all that. But the isolation my kids went through, I saw the effects on the their mental health. I felt the effects of the pressure of, am I going to have a job or not? What do I do about my kids? How are they doing? Like, it just weighed on you, everything. And then, you know, we started getting back to normal, quote unquote. But the fact is, I feel like I sometimes still have residual effects from what we went through. Like, I find, like, I need to process more, like, what happened during that time and how I'm still feeling about it. And, like, realizing I need to take more time to take care of myself. I was, you know, my wife and I were so focused on making sure everyone around us was okay. And you sometimes forget to check in on you. And like we just went, you know, just the other day, it happened to be a holiday that my wife and I had off, but the kids, a rarity, had school. We're like, woohoo! And we're like, we're getting massages. And it's just
Mom
like
a
day of pampering. And I didn't realize how much tension my body was holding on to for all the stress, you know, that we've been going through the past year of buying a business and running it and taking on these new roles and responsibilities. And I realized, like, I got to take care of myself. How have you been doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like you said, having, you know, bought the company a year, year and a half ago now, it definitely does do a number on your mental health sometimes. You know, you really do have to check in with yourself. And I think I probably mentioned earlier this year that one of my kind of goals for the new year, not resolution necessarily, but goals, was to really try and find to take my own time back, especially like weekends. Because when we purchased the company, and even before that, as you remember, we had about a year, 9 months or so of planning to purchase the company. It was working. You felt like 24/7. You know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, you just felt like you never had a chance to shut off. And I really made a conscious effort to try and take my weekends back for myself. It doesn't always happen, but try and take them back at least one day of the weekend and just know you don't, you can put it aside and you can take care of yourself and you can, you know, go to the gym. I started going to the gym again to get some exercise and just feel like I'm doing something for myself that takes me away from constantly thinking about work. So to me, and I've never been the kind of person that's like, I love going to the gym. Let's go to the gym. But I really do love taking that time for myself and going to do that. I mean, once sometimes I'm there and I'm like, I just want to go home because it's the gym. But still, it's finding those things that help help you take care of yourself a little bit more. And in also, you know, when it gets to the point where you feel like you can't do it yourself, it makes sense to go see somebody and talk to somebody about that. And, you know, candidly, in the past, I have, you know, had mental health situations where it's like I can't handle this on my own right now. I need to go talk to somebody else. And it's it was a major help in my life. So I'm definitely a proponent for seeking help.
I have seen the differences made in the life of my eldest. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, we do this together, and it has been such a help for me, and it has improved the way he and I communicate. Because mm-hmm. it's like this one space where we're not dealing with, like, we're not dealing with the typical parental issues, and we can focus in on those things that are really important and explain to each other why we're feeling the way we do. And mm-hmm. it's like, of course we all need to take more time to be able to do that. So I think we've talked enough about us. Let's talk to someone who can really delve in, help us understand the importance of what we've all been going through and the importance of taking care of your mental health, and explore her own entrepreneurial journey today.
Absolutely. Yes, let's do that. Our guest this week is Nicole Sublette, a licensed psychotherapist in New Hampshire. She's the owner and founder of Therapists of Color New England, the first BIPOC, Black Indigenous People of Color psychotherapy group in New Hampshire. Services include mental health counseling, hypnotherapy, somatic treatment, neurofeedback, and integrative medicine for mental health. In partnership with NAACP, Nicole is bringing racial healing circles to the state of New Hampshire to support folks in healing from incidents of racism. Prior to founding her company in 2023, Nicole had been providing therapy in New Hampshire since 2019. She is a New Hampshire licensed psychotherapist with an MA from Antioch University, New England, a doctoral candidate in natural medicine, a National Guild of Hypnotists certified hypnotherapist, Reiki master, empowerment coach, feminine mentor, social advocate, and mother of three. She has published several wellness articles and developed nonprofit programs. Nicole serves as board member of NAMI NH. Recently, she won a scholarship from Harvard Kennedy School's Social Innovation and Change Initiative to attend Harvard Business School's Power and Influence for Positive Impact. Nicole also developed a culturally responsive training for behavioral health care providers in the state of New Hampshire. She is a public speaker and has also done several diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice trainings for organizations throughout the state. Nicole was the recipient of the 2023 New Hampshire Business Review's Business Excellence Award in the category of social equity. She is also a 2024 nominee for the Center for Women in Enterprise's Rising Star Award. Nicole, that's an impressive resume. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm super, super excited to be here with you both today.
Well, we have so much to delve into. I think, you know, I'd like to start with just kind of going into what we call the Wayback Machine and talking about what kind of kid were you growing up, and what did you aspire to be, and what eventually led you down the path to becoming a therapist?
Well, growing up, I was always one of those dreamy, intuitive kind of children. If anyone's into astrology, I'm a Pisces. And so helping people was something I always wanted to do. And also just really listening to people. I was always curious and intrigued about people's stories and really learning them and understanding them. And I think innately being a mental health therapist was just kind of my expression of who I wanted to be when I was little. I didn't have that term mental health therapist when I was little, but I was like, I definitely want to be with people. And then when I was a little bit older, in high school, I knew I wanted to explore psychology, sociology. I even won the Sociology Excellence Award in high school. And so I kind of knew. I didn't start out as a mental health therapist in my career, but I knew since I was very young it's something that I wanted to do.
And so what was your path to becoming a therapist?
So my path to becoming a therapist, I worked for several years in supporting people who struggled with physical disability and some cognitive disabilities. I was a personal care assistant. And then following that, I actually worked in educational travel for about 10 years. And what had happened was I kind of hit the glass ceiling of where I was going. Mm-hmm. And I just knew, even though I loved travel, I loved education, that I really wanted to go back to the passion of being a mental health therapist. And also, though, side note, I did miss this part. My mother always discouraged me from being a psychologist. She's always like, oh, you got to be practical. She was a banker. You got to do something practical with your life. So I actually, in undergrad, I studied geography. I have an undergrad degree in geography, and I studied map making, GIS systems. And I'm telling you, if I had become a map maker, all of y'all would be driving into ponds. I have like the worst sense of direction ever, ever. Ask my husband. I'm like, no, you're going the wrong way. And he's like, I'm pretty sure we're going the right way, Nicole. So I'm glad I didn't pursue that because it wasn't a passion anyways.
And so when you did decide that therapy was the route you wanted to go, as you entered it, what did you find in terms of what that course of study and that industry was looking like? And did you feel like you fit into it? Or did you walk into rooms where you were the only person of color or one of the few women of color in the room? And what did that mean for you?
Yes. Well, studying therapy in my specific graduate degree program, there wasn't a ton of diversity, even though the school did make attempts to diversify the campus. The thing, though, about higher education is that it's not necessarily accessible. Mm-hmm. And so what I found in graduate school, though, also was that you either find the affluent or you find those who might be in a lower socioeconomic status. You didn't see a ton of middle class women when I went to graduate school. So if you're in my bucket, you have to take out a ton of student loans to become a therapist. So there wasn't a lot of people of color, because when we think about historically who has access to wealth historically, mm-hmm. it's not people of color. And so it's sometimes it can be a barrier to access higher education levels if you come from a lower socioeconomic status, which I did, because you have to go into big amounts of debt.
Right. And so what kind of ripple effect does that have in the field of therapy? And what does that mean for people, and particularly people of color, who are seeking out therapists and therapists who understand what they might be going through?
Well, it has a ripple effect in so many ways. And so the first thing, though, one of the ripple effects is that if we think about what we call the founding fathers, that gives you an idea. So, you know, therapy, psychotherapy, psychology is based on maybe a male dominant, more male centered perspective. If we think about some of our favorites like Freud or Jungian philosophy. And so there wasn't a lot of diversity influencing how we conceptualize mental health, how we conceptualize psychology, and also a lot of discrimination. One of the first mental health diagnoses for African slaves was drapetomania. What does that mean? Drapetomania was pathologizing slaves who wanted to run away or wanted their freedom and autonomy. So there is a bit of racial prejudice and racial bias in the field of psychology alone, historically. So when I went there, there's two things happening. One, there was not a lot of diversity. And two, it's also teasing apart what we learned and how people think. And I also found how we were treating people and what we're learning was not necessarily what I'd call culturally responsive. Mm-hmm.
So, what have been some of the work that you've done to help diversify the industry of therapy?
So, some of the work that I've done is that I do a lot of advocacy around the way that we conceptualize people. I know earlier you were talking about the stigma around mental health. Well, there's different layers of stigma. And some of the work that I do is I help to train people about culturally responsive care. It's just kind of understanding what biases do we have when we're coming to the field, when we're treating people, what sense of information are we coming with historically? How do we view different populations? How do we view diversity? And how does that show up in a therapy room? And so part of that is training other therapists to see, where do I hold bias? Maybe where do I hold prejudice? Where do I hold stereotype? And how can I move through that to create a more welcoming and sacred space? So that's one way that I do that. And then also my practice specifically is just also hiring other people of color. So we also, in my practice, have a safe haven where we can be together and change the way that we're actually looking at therapy. And it's a trauma-sensitive space, especially trauma that we find around experiences of racism, marginalization, oppression, and discrimination.
So as you enter your profession, can you talk about what your own history was in entering the field? And at what point did you stop and say, I need to create something of my own and something that's better?
I think entering the field is a really long and complex question, and so I'm going to make it short for time's sake. entering the field, one thing that I noticed and that always was kind of shocking to me, we had what they called cultural competency training. Well, the thing is, we're never competent in a culture that we don't know. So there's never a level of competency being had, but that cultural competency training was like an hour and a half. One time. Whereas we have other trainings all the time, right? Where we're constantly refreshing how we do cognitive behavioral therapy or motivational interviewing and all these other types of therapy. We'd always have training on that. But only one training coming to diversity. And that always was something that was really jarring because as we know that culture and diversity is so nuanced, complex, and has so much depth to it. And so I felt like that there needed to be more. And then also, while I knew that I was a very good therapist, sometimes I was first seen as the Black therapist. And so my identity preceded my profession. And so I always kind of struggled with that. And I know that in some of the trainings we had, there was actually blatant non-trauma sensitive language. There's also blatant racist language in the trainings. And when I would put in a complaint or say something, I'd often be silenced. And I knew that as a Black woman, that it didn't feel like a safe enough space. And then I also knew with some of my colleagues who might've identified as a person of color, it didn't feel safe to them. And I knew that there needed to be something different. Even more than that, though, which was the most prolific thing for me that changed it, it made me want to start my own thing, is that I would often see clients of color, I'd see Black clients, and they would come to me about their experiences of prejudice or racism and discrimination. And I would sit and I'd offer them presence and really listen and connect to them. And they would always share with me the same thing. That's the first time they actually felt believed, because oftentimes they were being gaslit in therapy. Their experiences of racism were consistently being invalidated, being told things like, oh, well, we all just have different experiences. And so therapy, which is supposed to feel safe, never felt safe.
And we'll be right back. Are you looking for quality networking in a fun environment? Join Business NH Magazine for the return of the ultimate Biz NH Bash at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center in Concord on March 28th. Meet leaders from New Hampshire's 2023 Top 100 Private Companies, Top Women-Led Businesses, Top Family-Owned Businesses, and New Hampshire's Startup Stars, plus the 40 influential leaders in New Hampshire as featured in the January issue of Business NH Magazine. Enjoy delicious appetizers and cocktails, explore museum exhibits, take fun photos in our photo booth, and mingle with the stars of New Hampshire business while gazing at the stars. For more information, visit businessnhmagazine.com/events. Sponsored by Merchants Fleet, Northeast Delta Dental, Unitil, Ledyard Bank, Eversource, and UHY Advisors. Buy local at the 27th Annual Made in New Hampshire Try It and Buy It Expo on April 5th, 6th, and 7th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Expo Center in downtown Manchester. Browse a dazzling array of locally made products and sample tons of tasty treats. Purchase fine jewelry, clothing and accessories, bath and body products, handcrafted items for the home, one-of-a-kind art pieces, and more. And you'll be supporting local businesses. And don't forget to say hello to all the rescue animals at Live and Let Live Farm. Swing by the Libation Station to sample and buy wine, beer, mead, and spirits all made in the Granite State. So bring the entire family to the Made in New Hampshire Try It and Buy It Expo at the DoubleTree by Hilton Expo Center on April 5th, 6th, and 7th. You won't believe what's made in New Hampshire. For more information or to apply to be a vendor, visit madeinnhexpo.com. Sponsored by Northeast Delta Dental and Business NH Magazine. And we're back.
And so, Nicole, you were in our February issue and on the cover. And in reading your story, it was so powerful to me in this point that you just brought up that, you know, for people of color that experience racism, there's already that trauma that's there. And then they go to seek mental health counseling to help deal with that trauma and then are further traumatized because they're made to feel like their experience wasn't real or has been invalidated in some way. In a state of New Hampshire where we are becoming a much more diverse state, but was still a very much white majority state, what is that like for patients to have to deal with that re-traumatization? And how difficult is it for them to find a therapist who will have a better understanding of what they're going through in the first place?
It's difficult in many ways. And because New Hampshire historically has a lack of diversity, which is changing from the children up, New Hampshire has often failed to recognize that it has problems with racism and discrimination, and that's very alive and well in the state. How it impacts communities of color is that it is found that trauma literally changes the DNA. Trauma accelerates aging. Trauma creates what is called a weathering effect. So it starts to become erosive on the body. So it not only has mental health implications, right, of people experiencing or witnessing discrimination or racism, but the body takes a toll. And people of color are more likely to die early or face cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes. And so it is what I'd call an epidemic of sickness. Racism is an epidemic of sickness, and it causes a lot of harm. And so when they come and find my practice, I'm really trying to create a space of vitality. We're often given the terms, well, you just got to be more resilient. Well, how much more resilient do we have to be? Resilience is an idea of taking away from someone. We have to be up against it, kind of like slamming against this wall over and over again. But how can we actually come back and build vitality so we can live and feel fulfilled? And that is the goal for my practice, is to create these really sacred, safe, and healing spaces. And we know that healing can be done just through really good listening. Actually, the key to a good relationship is actually listening.
And so when you decided to start this, your practice, and to also have the focus of the practice, that's a huge step for anybody to take, is to go out of the comfort zone of working for someone else and going, I believe enough in myself and in this concept, I'm going to strike out on my own and make this work. What was the tipping point for you to do that? And what has been the response since you've established your practice?
I think the tipping point for me is that was being, even though I was recognized for the work that I did as very well, but my experiences of oppression, being invalidated, also being a female, was creating its own weathering effect for me in the system that I was working in. And that was the tipping point. I knew that if I stayed, it wouldn't be good. Because I felt like the work was actually taking me out instead of, fulfilling me. And so that was really the tipping point. And literally it was, I also think there was a lot of synchronicity, because I think literally the first week I was in private practice and I got a call from WMUR and they wanted me to speak on something. I think it was about like families and the health of families and stuff. And I was like, whoa, is this a prank?
That was fast.
I was like, yeah, that's right. I was like, me? But all these doors just started opening and slowly getting this recognition. And then also I started in private practice, and then really the pandemic kind of hit. And so like within my first few months, I had 700 requests for treatment.
Wow. And the pandemic really, in two ways, transformed our understanding and need for mental health, it seemed. On the one hand, I think that collective trauma we went through made more people realize just how much all of us need to take care of our mental health, and maybe broke down some of those stigmas that were around it. And there was much more talk around the need to take care of your mental health in addition to your physical health at the time. At the same time, it seemed to really shine a spotlight on the dire situation we were in when it came to available mental health services and available mental health services at all levels. I know for, you know, my family, we adopted my two sons, which is great. And so my eldest, though, you know, it was dealing with a lot. Between the pandemic and between, you know, growing up and becoming a teenager and realizing some things that happened in his life maybe shouldn't have happened, and trying to get mental health services, it was amazingly hard, harder than I thought it was going to be. And trying to traverse the system, and because, you know, we were able to keep them on a Medicaid program because they were adopted from the foster system, so that, which has amazing mental health coverage and far better than our private insurance. But then you run into who accepts it and who doesn't. And it really opened my eyes between who gets access to mental health and who doesn't. And it's hard enough when you have resources anyway because of the lack of mental health professionals that are available to find that. But then where you end up on the economic scale can also determine not only your access, but the quality of the access that you're going to have and who you have access to, whether there's someone that's really an established professional with a, you know, a strong history of treating, or someone that may be just coming in and is being overseen and is more of an intern. And it just opened my eyes as to kind of the dire situation we find ourselves in. As someone who's on the front lines of that, can you talk about where you see the field of mental health in New Hampshire right now and the issues of availability we have, and how is that playing into the need versus the availability?
That's a really big question. And I think that in so many ways, you know, the state, there's a lot of advocacy in the state, and there's a lot of advocacy for also shifting policies. But I think there's a long ways to go. And I think part of it, if policy, if we look at some of the state programs like Medicaid, historically Medicaid is not great at reimbursing providers, one, timely, and also the amount of reimbursement. Small businesses like mine could not sustain on Medicaid. One, because of the lack of timely payout, to the low reimbursement, and also some of the requirements. If you take Medicaid, you have to also be able to provide interpreter services. Well, an interpreter service is more than what a reimbursement would be for Medicaid. So you're actually going into the red. And so it makes it very difficult. But if we could advocate, right, to have better Medicaid payout to providers, which would make it more accessible. And so that's, I think, one thing that we can do as a state is really, for benefits for folks, really advocate for the people receiving the benefits and also for the providers taking the benefits. That's one thing that we can do. And I also think it also comes down to education, as I talked about earlier, is also lowering education costs, or having more avenues of repaying loans, just to make becoming a therapist more accessible, because it's just not, higher education is just not always accessible and requires quite a bit of risk. I know that I had to, when I was going to grad school, I had food stamps and I was receiving state assistance because I had to intern at least 20 hours a week, plus work full time, plus raise a child. I couldn't afford to technically go to school without taking on debt, which the debt paid my rent.
Wow. Just the layers that play into access to mental health is just amazing to me. It starts with people being able to access the education they need to become a therapist. It's amazing. So once you established your practice, what was the response like to it? What are you finding? Are you finding there was this great untapped need out there? What's it been like to build a new practice like this?
The response has been really incredible, really amazing. I didn't think that for myself when I started and I hired my first clinician, right? As soon as I hired my first clinician, I soon realized I needed a second clinician. And I soon realized I needed a third because the response was so great. It's still, it's a bit overwhelming, you know, because we're trying to meet a need and we're trying to meet a community need that's never been done in this state before. A practice like mine has not existed before. And just kind of being the first to do this. And we are also now in a partnership with Dartmouth College because Dartmouth is also seeing, you know, being an Ivy League school, wanting to make sure that their students of color are navigating better coming to a different environment, New Hampshire, Ivy League, lack of diversity. And so it's growing and it's expanding greatly, and it's going to continue to expand over the next few years as my goal is to actually hit more rural states like Vermont and Maine and also Massachusetts. But Vermont and Maine specifically have a lack of diverse providers because the need is so great. Mm. And the pandemic has really, as you were saying earlier, has highlighted that need where we're sitting. Oftentimes, I'm an introvert too, but we're just sitting with ourselves and there's really no distraction. And so we had to really kind of face like what was going on, whether it was within ourselves or within our family.
And you said when you got your first clinician, you realized you needed another and another. How many are you up to right now?
So right now, including myself, there's 5. And then in March, there will be 6.
Mm-hmm. Great. And do you have any plans for the future to add more? Like you were saying, you're maybe expanding into Vermont or Maine, Massachusetts.
Yeah, so the plan is to definitely to hire more clinicians because the need is so great. My clinician who is starting in March is already almost fully booked. And so we really want to meet the community, the need in the community as much as we can. That's also why we're doing the healing circles with the NAACP. It's also a way to – the healing circle, I want to go back, is a way – to create a space for people who have either witnessed racism, it's for people of color, or experienced racism, to share their hearts and to start to heal from the experience of racism. And we were able to receive a grant to do that. So it's totally free to the community. It's telehealth, so it's going to be available through the state of New Hampshire because I recognize not all people have access to care. And so I'm hoping that the healing circle will be able to help people who don't have access to care to be able to participate and have some form of care.
Have you had outreach from other therapists who are seeing what you're doing and thinking, I might want to strike out in this area and seeing a model that's out there now?
I've definitely had therapists connect with me that want to start a group practice. Again, though, if we're looking at therapists of color, Black therapists, there still tends to be very few. Mm. There's only, I think, from what my research, not many that live in the state. There's some that practice, live out of state, and maybe do telehealth in, but there's not many. And so if you're to go on Psychology Today, and if you're like looking at Black therapists, most of those therapists work for me. That's how stark lack of diversity, and only 4% nationally, if in the field of psychology, only 4% are people of color.
Where would you like to see your own practice go, and what do you hope it might inspire?
I hope that my practice does expand across New England, and if it has to, beyond. My hope is to really to create healing spaces again where we're really creating a place of safety, a place of vitality. We need it. I mean, there's so many forms of oppression. Not only does my practice specialize in Black, Indigenous, people of color, also specializes in LGBTQIA plus communities. And so I'm hoping that my practice is really a safe haven for those who have historically and traditionally experienced marginalization and oppression. And so wherever that reach can grow and go, that's where I want it to be, because we need it, especially right now. Things feel super uncertain to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so creating as many safe spaces as we can is my goal for my practice.
And so when you aren't helping others, which with some incredibly difficult issues, what do you do to take care of yourself?
So I have a very rigorous self-care routine, and it varies given on the season or the year. But I do like to wake up in the mornings and exercise or do yoga. I make sure to get outside at least once a day. It doesn't matter. It could be a blizzard. It could be a flood. You know, maybe I shouldn't be outside in floods, but I've got to be outside because it helps me to ground and recenter, because I know that if I'm not good, then the people I serve won't be good. Also, whenever I feel that I might need help, is also seeking help from somebody. There's, to me, no stigma in ever receiving help. Just taking care of myself. That's what I do. And then spending time, you know, with my family. Those moments are really precious. I've got kids that are, you know, growing up faster than I'd like. So.
Well, thank you for a fascinating discussion. I appreciate you coming in today.
Yes, and I think first of all, it's great to know that our therapists are also taking care of their own mental wellness. We're glad to hear that because there is so much that you take on from your clients and your patients, I'm sure. But Nicole, yes, as Matt said, thank you again for joining us. Nicole Sublett is the owner and founder of Therapists of Color New England. Thank you again.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed the stories and information you heard on today's podcast, find more by subscribing to Business NH Magazine or visiting businessnhmagazine.com. I'm Matt Mowry.
And I'm Christine Kerrigan. BizCast NH is a production of Granite Media Group.